State v. Longford. Smash Hall, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state.
May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Jennifer Nashold, and I represent the state of Wisconsin in this appeal. The state is asking that this court reverse the Court of Appeals decision because that decision was based on two erroneous assumptions. First, the court applied an incorrect standard for the stop of the defendant's vehicle, that of probable cause to arrest rather than reasonable suspicion for a Terry stop. Second, the court held that if a stop is based on an erroneous interpretation of a statute, the stop is per se unlawful, regardless of whether the officer's interpretation of that statute was reasonable and regardless of whether the statute at issue is ambiguous. I'll first analyze the standard for stopping the defendant's vehicle. Now, both the Court of Appeals and the defendant believe that the probable cause to arrest standard applies in this case to the stop of the defendant's vehicle. But because they base their beliefs on different rationales, the state will first address the Court of Appeals rationale and then move on to discuss the defendant's analysis. The Court of Appeals applied a probable...
Yes, so what's the... How would you state the issue in this case?
I mean, you said it's probable, reasonable suspicion for a Terry stop for investigation. Is that your position?
My position is that the stop of the vehicle was a Terry stop and that it should be based on reasonable suspicion and not probable cause.
Well, is it reasonable suspicion in order to further investigate? That's what I'm trying to get at.
The state's point is that what happened here, the initial stop of the defendant's vehicle did not constitute an arrest, nor was there any indication that the officer intended to arrest the defendant in this case. And furthermore, even if the officer was simply going to issue a citation for the safety glass statute, that does not constitute an arrest, according to Knowles v. Iowa and an abundance of other authorities.
So he was stopping for investigation.
Mm-hmm. But the stop did not constitute an arrest.
Well, stopping to issue a citation, right?
Possibly. We don't know. We can't get into the mind of the officer to see what the officer was going to do, but the officer did observe what he believed was a reasonable basis to conclude that the defendant had violated the safety glass statute.
Just tell me, so I understand the facts, as I understand it, the back window had no glass in it, and there was some type, what was over?
It was a plastic covering, and the window was broken out.
Okay. It was not opaque.
You could see through it?
Right, you could see through it. But the window had been broken out, and it had been replaced with plastic. And so the officer believed that that constituted a violation of the safety glass statute. However, he was not arrested for that. He was arrested ultimately for 8th offense OAR, OWI related. And he was arrested on a contempt warrant.
How do you know that people could see through it?
How do we know that they could see through it? Well, there's just nothing in the record to indicate otherwise.
So in other words, it's one way. In other words, the officer could have determined that he couldn't see through it. I mean, was that reasonable?
Because there's just nothing in the record indicating that. I suppose that could be true.
So that's open for us.
That's not the violation.
Yeah, that's correct.
Right.
Stopped.
It was just violation of the safety glass statute.
Well, do.
All right. A reasonable and articulable of a violation of the motor vehicle code. Does it have to be a particular violation of the motor vehicle code?
Well, there have been cases, I don't recall the names of them, where Wisconsin courts have said that there has to be a reasonable suspicion that a crime has occurred and you don't have to, or a crime or an offense has occurred, and you don't have to name the specific statute which applies. And, you know, even in Terry v. Ohio, there wasn't a specific crime, I don't believe, that the officer named. He did believe that perhaps they were casing the joint or something, but suspicious activity has been grounds for Terry stop, even where a statute is not specifically named. But here the officer stated that he believed it constituted a violation of the safety glass statute.
Well, there is a statute on obstruction of operator's view.
Right, and I don't know whether the officer, there's just no indication that that was what the officer pulled the person over for. But
counsel, I want to stay on this record issue. Are you saying there is nothing in the record one way or the other as to whether or not this plastic was plastic that you could readily see through?
I don't believe there is, and perhaps defense counsel can answer that better than I can, or if the court would like, I can go through the record yet again and figure out whether that's the case. But because it wasn't an issue in this case, and the officer clearly stated that it was the safety glass statute that he pulled the person over for, I did not look into that as extensively as perhaps I could.
Let's ask the question a little differently. Suppose the officer thinks that it's a violation to have plastic, and it turns out it's not. But it was a violation that there was something else with the car. Okay. So, is that going to be enough to justify a Terry stop?
And it's something else that was completely different, or are you talking about...
Well, we can start with completely different, then we'll move you into something like Justice Process said, because you need to state in a reasonable and articulate way why you're making the stop. And he may not have to say that it's burglary three,
right.
But he has to say, do you have to pick on a...
If it was suspicious for other reasons, then yes, I think that that would be a legitimate basis for a stop.
But if he doesn't have that kind of suspicion, then he can't just draw it in later that a reasonable officer should have had that suspicion.
Well, I suppose if it were something, if it was later determined that there was something else wrong with the car, like a tail light, but the officer had no awareness of it at the time, then I don't think that Terry has applied to those types of situations.
So even if this was not transparent plastic, and he doesn't think that it's the transparency or opaqueness that's the issue.
Well, and that, I guess I do just see a distinction there between that and the taillight scenario, because it's still based on this suspicious set of facts, namely this plastic in the window. So I think you can draw a distinction there,
that he doesn't have
to name the specific statute.
Even if he can't articulate it, and it's not opaque, transparent, but just that this plastic.
That's right.
Okay.
Well, isn't there a whole body of law that says if a police officer acts under an incorrect theory of law, but nevertheless his action is consistent with a correct theory of law, that it's okay?
If the officer acts under an incorrect theory of the law,
if in the subjective mind of the officer, he is acting under one set of conclusions, and that it turns out to be incorrect.
That's absolutely correct. I see what you're saying, and that is the case, that if an officer has some other reason, some other invalid reason, for example, to stop a person, and it turns out that actually there was a valid basis for the stop, then the officer's other motivation, a subjective belief about something else, or an incorrect reason for pulling the person over, it doesn't matter. I mean, we've got Wren and other pretext cases that say that that doesn't matter.
That's why I'm interested in what Justice Bradley and Prosser were here, because if, in fact, you can't see through that plastic box, and you've got, even if you stopped that car under an incorrect theory of law, nevertheless, there was a correct theory
of law. I would agree with that.
So, but we don't have that fact, huh?
As far as I know, we don't. He's dying to say something. I don't know what the court wants to do with that.
I have to say that the record is ambiguous, but in fact, it was transparent and inclusive in both of the cases.
Well, it was 2:00 in the morning.
Yes. However, that was that reason was has fallen by the wayside, unfortunately, during the course of this appeal. And it wasn't raised at the Court of Appeals level and
No.
Oh, okay. You're talking just about
it. I look at a piece of plastic during the day when there's light all around. I ought to be able to see inside. I'm looking from the outside. People can look the other way, from the inside to the outside.
Are you saying that because it was 2 o'clock in the morning, perhaps the officer couldn't have made that determination because of bad lighting, or are you saying the lighting was good so an officer could have made that determination?
I think there might be questions.
I agree, and that's where I completely disagree with the Court of Appeals analysis in this case, because the court just assumed that no investigation was needed, and there's absolutely no basis for that. That's not the court's job. It's the officer's job to determine whether investigation is needed. And whether investigation is needed has furthermore never been the touchstone or the determinative factor as to whether the standard is reasonable suspicion or probable cause. And this whole idea that there are offenses for which nothing can be gained by further investigation is simply faulty. Even for the most basic speeding case, although an officer may have got someone on radar at a certain speed, an officer routinely goes up to the car and says, "How fast do you think you were going?" and uses that information as well. So there's no basis for concluding that there are just a class of offenses, or even in this particular situation, that no investigation was needed.
Well, and doesn't that also presuppose that the scope of the investigation would be limited to the traffic violation, which was the original justification for the stop, when that may not be the case?
That's true as well.
2 o'clock in the morning, with a punched-out rear window with plastic over it, he's got to be thinking stolen car.
That's correct.
He's got a basis to stop the car.
Often in these situations, something else can develop. And if nothing else did develop here, we don't know what would have happened, whether the defendant would have been issued a citation, whether he would have been given a warning, or what would have happened here. Therefore, this probable cause to arrest standard simply does not make sense here. And it's also illogical in another way, because what it says is that if it relies on this idea that no investigation is needed, what that means is that if there's less evidence, it's okay to stop with reasonable suspicion, but if there's more evidence, then you need a higher standard for the stop. So the more likely it is that a crime has been committed, the harder it's going to be to make that stop. Also, just as far as workability for both officers and for appellate courts, does this court really want to be engaged in making the kind of determinations regarding investigation that is usually left up to the officer? Because this court is going to be, what the Court of Appeals decision requires is that henceforth appellate courts are going to have to be saying, well, okay, when looking at the standard here, we have to look at whether investigation was needed. The officer had factors A, B, C, but the officer didn't have D and F, so therefore investigation was needed, therefore the reasonable suspicion standard applies. And it also is unworkable for officers, because when they're making that determination on a stop, they're going to have to be determining, well, what do I have here? Have I seen enough? Have I seen too much? Have I seen too little to pull this person over on reasonable suspicion? It doesn't make sense. And it also writes out language from this court and from 968-24 that says that that reasonable suspicion applies even if the offense or the officer believes the offense has been committed or is being committed. And that contemplates the officer seeing basically what he believes to be an offense. The defendant's position is somewhat different. It basically says, well, it's transformed throughout the course of this case. At the trial court level, the defendant agreed that the standard was reasonable suspicion. And then in briefing at the appellate courts, the defendant's position changed. The defendant advocated a probable cause standard while conceding that most traffic offenses are going to require a reasonable suspicion standard. The defendant said, but if there's no investigation needed in these traffic offenses, then the standard is probable cause. There was no authority for that, and again, arrested on this idea of no further investigation. 2 days ago, I'm sorry.
Would it make a difference here if this was not a traffic stop, but a stop for an arrest for, let's say, a burglary? Let's say the cop is standing out of the corner, he sees his car go by, and he thinks he recognizes the driver as somebody that he saw in a wanted poster, and the car corresponds to the description he was given about a burglary, so he stops. So that's not a traffic stop.
Right. I don't think it makes any difference. I think that that you have to look at what was done and then look at whether what the standard was.
You can stop that car under reasonable suspicion. He has every intention of making an arrest. He's going to stop that car and arrest this guy for burglary. And then he gets up and finds out that...
If an arrest occurred, then I think that maybe you'd be looking at a probable cause standard. But if an arrest doesn't, based on those factors, then I still think you'd be looking at reasonable suspicion.
And what does he have to say? He's supposed to do a reasonable, articulable statement of why he stopped, right?
That's right.
So here he said, and I think I'm quoting from the right transcript, "What did you observe at 2:04 a.m. as you were on Oneida Street?" Answer, "I observed a 1988 Chevy four-door exiting a closed business." Question, "Do you remember what business or businesses?" Answer, "I don't recall exactly which ones they were. In any event, as you were on patrol, those questions were closed." Question mark. Answer, "Yes, they were." Question, "And were the lights off in the businesses?" Answer, "Yes, they were." Question, "Were you in a marked squad car?" "Yes, I was." "And were you in uniform?" "Yes, except, I guess, for a tie." Question, "All right. When you saw this vehicle coming out from behind the closed business or in between the closed business?" Answer, "I didn't observe exactly where the vehicle was positioned before I arrived at the location. I did observe a vehicle in front of the business. And as I approached, it pulled out in front of me onto Oneida Street." Question, "You simply saw this leaving the grounds of this closed business?" Answer, "Correct." Question, "When you saw the vehicle leaving this closed business, what did you do?" Answer, "I began to follow it." Question, "Why are you doing that?" Answer, "Because it appeared to me suspicious due to being 2 o'clock in the morning and the businesses being closed. Usually you don't see vehicles in and around businesses that are closed at that time of the morning." Question, "Where did the vehicle..."
For justice, I think at that point, does the officer have a sufficient reasonable suspicion to stop that car?
Perfect.
Well, I think that the circuit court analyzed this in a pretty thorough way and said, you know, in most cases there has been more than this. So, you know, I think that my personal feeling is that this could have constituted reasonable suspicion, but I agree with the circuit court that in most cases there's been more than this. In most cases there's been drug deal, or it's a drug neighborhood or something else. The business has been burglarized a lot of times in the past. So I can't say that I've seen cases that have this low of a threshold, but that isn't to say that it doesn't meet a reasonable suspicion standard.
Okay, and so that's where we are, and apparently this officer didn't think he had enough either because he didn't do it.
Didn't stop then.
And he followed, and the questioning is, did you turn on lights and sirens? And the answer is no. And then, did you run a license check? And he says, yes, I did. Did you make observations? Answer, I did observe that it would have been the driver's rear window, passenger side, or passenger's rear window to be broken out with plastic covering it tape. When you noticed the vehicle defect, as you were following the vehicle north, what did you do? The vehicle came to Lombardi Avenue and then headed west. At that time, I initiated a traffic stop. So, when you made the traffic stop, did you obtain identification? Answer, I did. Who was the driver? Michael Longcar. Is the person identified as present in the courtroom? Yes, etc. Did you either run a record check? That's the end of that, right?
Right.
At that time, says you have reasonable suspicion?
I believe so. And the court...
What?
The court found, the circuit court found that what the officer pulled the person over were for two reasons. One, this closed business, and the second thing was violation of the safety glass statute. And I'm not sure if that comes out later, but neither party disputes the findings of the trial court. Neither party is arguing that they were clearly erroneous. And so, therefore, each of us is conceding that the record sustained the trial court's findings, that these were the reasons that the traffic stop occurred.
Counsel, the trial court found, with regard to pulling out from the business, that that wasn't enough.
That's right.
To sustain a reasonable suspicion.
Right. I'm just talking about that the trial court found that there were two reasons for the stop and then subsequently said that one reason was invalid and then went on to hold that, well, I can't determine the meaning of the statute. I've looked at the legislative history of the statute, and I don't know whether it applies to the defendant's actions. But I'm going to say that because the officer's interpretation was entirely reasonable, that the stop is not invalidated if we later say, if we find out that it's not really applicable.
What did the officers say? Did the officer refer to the specific statute of 347-43?
On cross-examination, that I ended his testimony on direct, for all intents and purposes, right? You issued a citation for operating after revocation. That's what you did. On page 11 on cross, question, and the reason you stopped him was because of that violation with the window. Is that correct? Answer, actually two reasons, the violation of the window and also for the suspicious pulling out when it was closed.
Counsel, we have, I think it was referred to by Justice Prosser, for instance, 346-88, obstruction of operator's view. Sub 3 of that statute requires that there, you cannot, how to say this, that there must be transparent material.
That's right.
Arguably, we don't know apparently from the record, this was or wasn't transparent. You said the record is void on...
I think that it is.
You think that what is? The record is void?
That the record is void.
So, my question is, does the record reflect the officer specifically referring to 347-43, or another statute, or does the record reflect the officer just referring to a windshield violation and the circuit court judge then zeroing
in on? If all that has been read to me, and I haven't looked at the rebuttal, if there is any sort of rebuttal examination or statements made during redirect, if all that has been read to me is all that there is, then it would appear that it was just based on this plastic being in the windshield, which would cover possibly 346-88 and the safety glass statute. But I do not recall if later on in the record he specifically names the safety glass statute. But again, this was the finding of the trial court, and we haven't disputed that.
You've had quite a number of questions, and I don't know that you've gotten to your argument, so...
Thank you.
Not for any of your fault, but I...
Well, judging from the court's questions, I'm wondering...
Give a few more.
Okay, thank you. As I was... The point where I left off before the questions began to intensify was the point where I was talking about the defendant's position now on appeal. 2 days ago, I received a letter basically saying that the position has again evolved and that the defendant is no longer going to concede the fact that in most cases the reasonable suspicion standard applies to non-criminal traffic violations, but now it's just going to be a blanket rule, regardless of whether investigation is needed, that whenever there is a non-criminal, a pure non-criminal traffic violation, the standard is always going to be, or always should be, probable cause. And I would just like to quote this court's, one of this court's recent decisions, Renz.
I was waiting for this.
What?
No, nothing.
A brilliant decision.
That's the spirit.
Where what do you think of the dissent?
The court said that an officer may make an investigative stop if the officer reasonably suspects that a person has committed or is about to commit a crime, or reasonably suspects that a person is violating the non-criminal traffic laws. That's exactly what the state's position is in this case, and that's exactly what the state is asking this court to reaffirm here. This is nothing new. I cite an abundance of authority in my brief, pages 11 to 15, on all of the jurisdictions, including this court, including the Supreme Court, that have stated this as well. There's no reason to distinguish between a traffic stop and other criminal matters. It's what happened and does, and then you look at what standard to apply to what happened.
Well, you know, counsel, obviously the Court of Appeals didn't feel this is as easy as this.
That's
and
right.
They were a unanimous court. They're a highly respected court. And they recognize that the standard normally is reasonable suspicion. They quote it and they cite first part. Yet on the following page, they say that when an officer relates the facts to a specific offense, it must indeed be an offense.
That's right, and that goes to the second issue.
How did they go wrong on that? Where did they go wrong?
The state believes that this is an analogous situation to those cases such as Princess Cinema and De Filippo, where the court, like in Princess Cinema, said that the unconstitutionality of a statute does not render a search and seizure pursuant to that statute unlawful. And in De Filippo, the U.S. Supreme Court said that the unconstitutionality of the statute doesn't render an arrest pursuant to that statute unlawful. And I think that is conceptually analogous to the case at hand. The question is still reasonableness. And in either scenario, the basis for the stop, arrest, or search was not a legitimate offense under the law, and yet they said that the stop or the arrest was still reasonable. And in both scenarios, a court subsequently has to pass on the language and the meaning of the statute, and that's what still has to take place in this case. And in both scenarios, the prophylactic effect of the Fourth Amendment will not, of the exclusionary rule, rather, will not be affected in this case. The purpose of the exclusionary rule is to deter unlawful police conduct. And here there was no overreaching on the part of the officer. The officer made a reasonable interpretation of an ambiguous statute, and there's no reason to say that his stop was unreasonable. That's part of the calculus in determining whether the stop was reasonable. And I just want to point out one thing about the Court of Appeals decision that I think is an unfair characterization of the Circuit Court's decision and of the state's position in this case. The Court of Appeals basically said that what the Circuit Court did was say that you can have a reasonable suspicion about what the law is. And I don't think that is what occurred here. It's an unfair characterization of the Circuit Court's decision because this court does not have to hold that to resolve this case. It's a reasonable suspicion that a violation occurred. It's not a reasonable suspicion of what the statute says.
There was no statute about rear windows, but an officer might very well think there should be. I would think there should be, but suppose there was none. And he arrests. He stops. Is that going to be okay? Then he finds drunk driving or drugs or what have you.
Well, as I said,
okay?
Courts have used a Terry analysis in looking at whether there was some kind of unlawful conduct, even if it's undefined.
Well, this was defined. He said, I stopped him because he had a rear window that was plastic, and I thought the law was you can't have anything but glass. This was plastic.
Oh, and you're saying if there's no statute at all covering plastic, then I think we would be having a harder position to argue today. We're only asking that it be reasonable, and then there would be an argument that that's unreasonable. It's unreasonable to think that you can stop green cars whenever you see them, and that would perhaps be an analogous situation, although, of course, if visibility is impaired, you might have some kind of reckless driving or, I don't know, unsafe driving charge or something like that, but it has to be a reasonable belief.
Counsel, the Court of Appeals then went on to say
towards the end of the opinion that, in characterizing the circuit court's opinion, that it's almost like developing a new
good faith,
yes. It's like developing a good faith exception to the exclusionary rule. And they say, in the opinion, that no, they can't do that. They're the Court of Appeals. They cite prior cases and discuss it, Hoyer. Are you asking us to do that?
Well, I don't understand why the court thinks that it had, the court thought that it had to adopt the Leon good faith exception in order to resolve, in order to do what the state was asking it to do in that case. And, you know, this isn't a warrant case. It's just a question of whether the stop was reasonable. And that's the bottom line.
Well,
and
isn't
so
the
it
theory
be,
in part that, you know, that arguably the officer was operating under a mistake of law, and even if he was mistaken, he was operating with a good heart?
Well, not a good heart is definitely not enough. It has to be a reasonable interpretation. And, you know, I guess to me, I don't know that I care so much what this court calls it, whether it wants to call it good faith, but I don't think that that's necessary. And this court has, well, courts generally have said that an officer can stop someone based, even if the officer is mistaken on the facts. And the state just does not see conceptually a difference between if an officer is reasonably mistaken on the facts or reasonably mistaken about what the statute says.
What about the general rule that there is no such thing as a mistake of law, that is, people are held to know the law? I mean,
if a defendant
said, I didn't know I couldn't use plastic, he'd be liable anyway.
That's right, but we're not talking about whether the defendant can be convicted. I think that the state and the defendant are similarly situated when it comes to what happens when there's an ambiguous statute and it's interpreted either by the defendant or the officer erroneously. If it's interpreted erroneously by the officer, then the defendant isn't going to be convicted. And if it's interpreted incorrectly by the defendant, then the defendant gets convicted. So I think that they are similarly situated in that scenario. I am out of time, and I would ask that this court reverse the Court of Appeals decision.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, Ms. Nashold. Mr. Schmall, Assistant Public Defender.
Good afternoon. My name is William Schmall. I'm an Assistant State Public Defender, Appellate Division, and I represent Michael Longcor. Mr. Longcor, of course, was the defendant in the trial court and is the respondent here on review. By way of introduction, I have to confess that my written brief in this court probably created some confusion because of the almost zen-like way that I consolidated the subsidiary issues that were addressed in the Court of Appeals into one ultimate legal issue on review. For the sake of clarity, I will not do that in my oral remarks today. I will instead address the subsidiary issues individually. In addition, I would like to remind the court, as my colleague has just done, that my legal position has evolved somewhat since my written brief was filed. Specifically, I now maintain that the correct rule in this case, if we get past the statute, is that the proper Fourth Amendment standard for a purely civil offense is always one of probable cause, irrespective of whether the facts objectively justify further investigation of the offense or not.
Wait a minute. Probable cause. Now, we're talking about to stop. There was not an arrest. Is that right?
Probable cause. Correct.
Purely a civil...
I would maintain, Your Honor, that this motor vehicle seizure must be considered as a traffic arrest, irrespective of whether the officer may have later decided to let the motorist go without a ticket.
Look, I'm speeding down the highway. I'm doing more than 65. So there's no question I'm violating a Wisconsin speeding statute.
The red lights go on, I'm pulled over, and he or she asks me for a driver's license, et cetera, et cetera. Then I get a warning, and I'm then free to go. It all may have taken 5 or 6 minutes because there's a check on my driver's license. Okay? Standard operating procedure, right? Okay. Probable cause to pull me over, is that what you're saying?
Yes. What the officer does afterwards is irrelevant, in my opinion.
Probable cause to pull over a car.
To make a seizure, a warrantless seizure, that's correct. As I see it, there are three issues, actually, that are presented by the Court of Appeals.
If I'm on the street and he thinks I have stolen property because it looks like something that's just been reported stolen, he could stop me in without probable cause.
He could.
But he can't pull me over.
That's correct. Well, I don't know how you could stop someone on the street without pulling them over.
But I'm telling you, did you agree that the Terry stopped?
The stolen goods involves a crime, and for crimes we clearly allow reasonable suspicion investigative stops.
Does that make sense to you? I mean, under your theory, then, in order to stop a vehicle, if you've got reasonable suspicion, you can't, because you've got that probable cause. But
no.
In order to stop a person, you can, because you don't need probable cause.
No, not at all, sir. In fact, I believe the motor vehicle aspect of this case is something of a red herring.
Well, so suppose you think that stolen goods because he sees them on top of my car rack. Now he pulls me over. Reasonable suspicion.
Yes.
Because it's a crime.
Yes.
Speeding ticket, no. Jaywalking.
I believe jaywalking would be a civil, purely civil offense and would have to be tested by the probable cause standard. Again, as I see it, there are three issues arising from the Court of Appeals opinion. First, whether a remand is appropriate for interpreting the safety glass statute. My answer is no, and I will get to that very briefly. If a remand is not appropriate, then what does the statute mean, and could an officer reasonably interpret it so as to permit the stop in this case? Again, my answer will be no because of the plain language of the statute and longstanding practice in Wisconsin with vehicles having plastic windows. The second major issue is what we've already begun to address, and that is whether the proper Fourth Amendment standard for a warrantless motor vehicle seizure is probable cause rather than reasonable suspicion. My answer is yes, but not for the reason the Court of Appeals gave. The Court of Appeals gave the wrong reasoning. Court of Appeals concluded that because the offense was completed, the standard was probable cause, and I expect to show that that's wrong. The third issue is whether a finding of probable cause does require a correct theory of law, as the Court of Appeals concluded. My answer is yes. It's not easy to summarize why. There are actually several different reasons why. I do have some new insights to offer the Court that have occurred to me since my written brief was filed, and I hope I'll have a chance to get to them. So first, very briefly, I will address the statute. I say it's not facially ambiguous and that no reasonable officer could interpret it to prohibit plastic in a rear passenger window. I say that for the following reasons. First of all, the statute's plain language regulates glass. A person has to have safety glass wherever glass is used, not wherever a window material is used. Second, the statute on its face uses the words where glass is used, the present tense and in an active sense. It does not say wherever the manufacturer had installed glass, which is what the state is arguing. Depends upon what the definition of is.
Now, counsel, just from a common sense standpoint, and that's why, as you saw with the opposing counsel, we asked some questions about the opaqueness, and you answered, well, no one really knew whether you could see through it or otherwise. But on this part, when you're saying it is clear that safety glass should not be used in a rear window, I don't see it. Just tell me, did I miss something? Obviously, I apologize. I've got a running nose here, but what...
It's not against any
ordinance. I know. No, I don't want to be... There is a reasonable suspicion that I'm either allergic to something or I'm getting a cold. I would say that as I read 347-43-1, and you're just saying that it's just unreasonable for anyone to read it other than not using glass. That's what you're saying?
I'm saying it only regulates the use of glass, not window material.
What you're saying is that whenever there's glass in the car, it's got to be safe.
Correct.
So if he had no glass and no plastic, that would have been okay.
That would have not been regulated by this statute. There are motor vehicle administrative rules which would regulate that.
If he would have had nothing, would that be okay?
Again, this statute would not prohibit that, but there are certain motor vehicle administrative rules which I've quoted in my written brief, which regulate the side windows, the windshield, the rear window.
Well, how do you read, and I'm just reading the other part that says that the likelihood of injury to persons by objects from external sources, I'm talking about the glass, I'm talking about 347.43.3.
Yes, I understand. The state offered that as a suggestion that the purpose is not actually of this statute to worry about shattering plate glass, but to protect someone inside from some external object. Well, all I can say is if you adopt that interpretation, then it would seem to be a violation of the statute to roll the window down. In other words, to remove the safety glass from where the manufacturer had installed it so as to expose the passenger to something coming in the window. And I really don't think the legislature meant that you couldn't roll down the window.
What do those words mean then, that phrase?
I think they're trying to describe the dangers of shattered glass from some sort of an impact.
The phrase is Justice Wilcox just read it. It's two parts. It is, in sub three, likelihood of injury to persons by, I say, number one, objects from external sources, or two, by such glass when it is struck, cracked, or broken. What does the legislature mean by the phrase injury to persons by objects from external sources?
My answer to that would be that Your Honor has omitted the preceding qualifying phrase, which is in comparison with ordinary sheet glass or plate glass.
Let me read the whole thing. In this section, because I didn't mean to do that, in this section, safety glass means glass so treated or combined with other materials as to reduce in comparison with ordinary sheet glass or plate glass the likelihood of injury to persons by objects from external sources or by such glass when it is struck, cracked, or broken.
The key phrase there, Your Honor, being to reduce in comparison with ordinary sheet glass or plate glass the likelihood of injury.
Can that statute be interpreted to mean that one of the concerns of the legislature is injury to persons by objects from external sources?
Only in the sense of, again, causing shattered plate glass or sheet glass.
Well, but that's the next, or by such glass when it is struck, cracked, or broken.
Let me answer your question in a different way.
You've got to help me with that, because
I'm not old enough to have remembered what kind of motor vehicles traveled in Wisconsin in the 30s and 40s. This statute came into effect in the mid-30s. But I do remember the 50s and 60s, and we've had lots of vehicles traveling Wisconsin roads and highways for the last 45 years that have plastic windows, and there has not been any problem with them. There's been convertibles in the 1950s with plastic windows. Nowadays, if you have your law clerk look out the window for an hour and count up the number of sport utility trucks that have plastic window curtains going up and down the street, you will see, I think, there are dozens of them in Wisconsin in the wintertime. And I suggest to you that any ambiguity on the face of the statute, which I do not concede, is resolved by that fact of life, and for that same reason, any reasonable patrol officer would not have thought plastic in your window is unlawful.
Your brief mentions that I think 1934 was the genesis of this language, and then there's also, of course, reference to an attorney general's opinion, and I may be wrong, maybe something like a 1937 attorney general's opinion. Isn't it reasonable to assume that the legislature and the attorney general in the 1930s, when interpreting the statute or when enacting the statute, did not contemplate the use of plastic?
I agree. They did not contemplate it and did not mean to prohibit it.
It just wasn't. You attach in your brief an encyclopedia article on the genesis and the development of plastics. And what would be, from that article, your perception of when plastic that could be used in windows would be in suitably standard practice or suitable practice? Is that in the 50s or 60s, like you referenced earlier, in terms of convertibles?
That's the first that I am aware of it. I believe there were roadsters. By a roadster, I mean a vehicle that has a soft fabric top that folds down by hand rather than being motorized, which is what I consider a convertible to be. I believe in the 30s and 40s there were vehicles like that that would have also, because of the fabric, had a plastic window of some sort.
When you said, maybe I'm just not with it, but when you say cars having plastic in the 50s and 60s, I mean, are you talking about then the convertible roof that has the plastic in the back that when the convertible roof comes down, the plastic folds? That's what you're referring
yes.
to?
Yes, although the sport utility trucks that you see on the roads today also have plastic side curtains.
What's a plastic side curtain?
It's a plastic window on fabric that they put on sport utility trucks. Also in sports cars in the 1950s, in the MGB, Austin Healey, those kinds of cars did not have roll-up glass windows. They had a plastic side curtain on a fabric frame that would attach with snaps.
On the roof, as the roof comes, I mean, when you
right.
push the roof
correct.
Back, but on the sides, they're all glass, just on the roof.
No, before. No, the sides would be plastic windows.
I have one. They're glass, but it doesn't make any difference. And I have an MGB, so it's a roll-up. 1974 MGB has a roll-up window.
Okay, I think I was mentioning the 50s, but...
Oh, excuse me.
I had a 60s Sprite that had plastic.
Could
yeah,
I ask?
What color? In my sportier days.
Whether you're familiar with the administrative rules, trans
305.32. Page 4 of the respondent's brief.
Well, subsection 1 talks about all glass used in vent, side, or rear windows shall be safety glass.
Yes.
There's more. You get down to 3, the vent, side, and rear windows may not have cloudiness or etching in excess of 2 inches from any edge. Is that to prevent shattering? Is it for safety or is it for observation?
I frankly don't know. I obviously I didn't quote that portion of the rule because I didn't think it applied to this case. I can't answer that offhand.
I'll take you down to subsection 6. Tinting of rear side windows is permitted as follows. And then we get down to B. The windows are tinted by the application of tinting film to the inside of the glazing, provided that the combination of the glazing and tinting film permits passage through the windows of at least 35% of the visible light striking the window. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. This is sort of a film. This plastic is sort of in the nature of a film. Not any justification to check that out?
That's the point that I'm getting to, Your Honor, that would be a civil offense, purely civil, and one would have to have probable cause to effect the stop. I'm just moving to that portion of my remarks at this time.
So your black letter rule is probable cause, and your authority for that is?
What I'm about to say now. Thank you.
Say it.
All right. The rule that I propose is that a purely civil offense, that is, an offense that can never be a crime in Wisconsin, must be tested by the probable cause standard. What offenses are not pure civil? Well, for example, drunk driving or driving after revocation.
Didn't this court say in the Rents case, that, as read by your opposing counsel, that or reasonably suspects that a person is violating the non-criminal traffic laws, that reasonable suspicion is appropriate?
The court did say that, and I regret that the court did that because that was not necessary to the disposition of that case. And in fact, it relied upon an authority, State versus Griffin, in which the issue was not presented. The parties in State versus Griffin had conceded that the issue was reasonable suspicion and did not argue whether that was the proper standard.
So what's the authority for your proposed rule?
First of all, I suggest looking at United States versus Wren, which is cited in my brief, and in two particular locations in that opinion, indicates that the general task for traffic arrest is probable cause.
That's an arrest.
Yes, it's my position that a warrantless seizure of a motor vehicle for a pure civil offense is an arrest. It has to be, because there is no rationale, no proper rationale for making an investigative detention. Here's why. First of all, I'd like to point out the state is asking for a blanket rule for all motor vehicle stops. The standard should be reasonable suspicion. There's a couple things wrong with that. First of all motor vehicle stops are not the same. A motor vehicle stop is a set of facts, not a legal category. A motor vehicle can be stopped for suspicion of a crime or for a civil offense. It can be stopped for an offense where the facts objectively justify further investigation or not. And a motor vehicle stop can be conducted in such a way, sometimes, as to be virtually tantamount to an arrest, such as shooting out the tires or laying spikes across the road. So I suggest we need a case-by-case analysis to determine what the proper standard is. The cases, the general rule is one of a warrant based upon probable cause in order to make a seizure, but there are exceptions to that have been developed. One exception that has been developed is the investigative detention. But that has been predicated upon two key factors. First of all, the gravity of the public interest. In Terry v. Ohio and the subsequent cases, it was the public interest in preventing and detecting crimes. And in Brignone Ponce, the court looked to the public interest in stopping illegal border violations. On that point, the United States Supreme Court has indicated that there's a lower public interest when the offense is not a crime. And that's Welsh versus Wisconsin. And in fact, in Welsh, the Supreme Court was actually talking about an offense that could be a crime under some circumstances.
But that was a warrantless entry into a home, which implicates all kinds of different values.
That's true. But more than 2 pages of the court's official report was dedicated to showing that there's a different Fourth Amendment standard for non-criminal offenses. Second, the investigative detention doctrine has been predicated on whether the facts justify objectively further investigation, a need for prompt police action. If we look at an ordinary, pure civil traffic offense in this state, speeding or red signal violation or having plastic in your window, the public interest in that is quite low compared to a crime or an illegal international border violation. And most of the time, not always, but most of the time, it's an observed violation. That's how it takes place. The officer sees your car go through the red light. So the facts do not objectively justify further police investigation at that point. I'd add one other citation. You asked me what my authority was, Your Honor, and I gave you United States versus Wren. United States versus Hensley also has some interesting comments. It's cited in my main brief. Hensley basically proves the Court of Appeals rationale wrong, although not their conclusion. And Hensley, the United States Supreme Court, said that a Terry-type stop could be made for a crime even after the crime was completed. But the interesting thing, and the reason why I bring it up now, is the court said that's for a felony, and the legal analysis might be different if we're talking about less serious offenses than felonies. Now, that's mere negative implication, I agree, but it's food for thought when taken together with Welsh versus Wisconsin.
Counsel, I'm a little confused. It sounds to me like your argument, although disparaging a bit the Court of Appeals rationale, in some ways incorporates the Court of Appeals rationale. That is, you're suggesting that it's a no further investigation is needed. And that I understood to be the underpinning of the rationale of the Court of Appeals. They said probable cause in this case because it's a done deal. It was an observable, their language was, I believe, an observed or observable violation. No further investigation need be done, and therefore they didn't do reasonable suspicion. That seems to be part of your argument for your standard, and yet the reason I'm confused is because you keep on saying you disagree with them, or you don't like their rationale, or their rationale is wrong. So help me with that.
Hensley, I think, indicates that the Court of Appeals rationale was wrong. The question is not whether the offense is completed or not, because one can still do reasonable suspicion stops for crimes even after the crime has been completed. That's what Hensley says. I'm saying that that's still, though, a relevant factor, that the typical civil traffic violation does not justify further investigation. That's a factor that the court may and should consider in determining what the rule should be. In other words, the rationale that justified Terry and Brignone-Ponce does not exist for the typical traffic violation. But the rule should be whether there's probable cause or not, period, because of the lower public interest. Let me suggest to you the very high costs socially against our liberty interest that there would be if we said a reasonable suspicion investigative stop were to be permitted for pure civil traffic offenses. Well, what that would mean is that an officer could stop you in your car not because you have a defective muffler, but because he thinks you might, or that he thinks your taillight was flickering as if the wire were loose, and that might be a defective taillight.
Oh, that would never qualify under reasonable suspicion. It has to be reasonable and articulable, and you can't have it just based upon hunches or speculation, etc. That's
well, the traffic code says a defective muffler and a defective taillight are a violation.
Oh, I understand that, counsel, but the officer has to have concrete and specific and articulable
The officer
those
sees
sorts of violations just like any other kind of violation. You can't just have a hunch about it and then do it.
The officer sees your car going by on the highway, and it appears to the officer that the taillight flickered. That, I think, is an articulable suspicion.
No, then he's going to get behind you, and he's going to follow, and he's going to look, and he's going to see if it's actually broken. And if it's broken, he's going to pull you over.
Maybe the officer would do that, but we're asking what the standard should be, what he should be authorized to do.
Well, and in that sense, does it make any sense whatsoever to apply an arrest
standard of cause to a situation where somebody is not going to be arrested, but rather issued a ticket. Does that make any sense whatsoever?
I'm saying it would not make sense to allow officers to stop vehicles on suspicion of those kinds of violations.
But you're asking us to apply the standard of cause that applies to an arrest, where someone is actually going to be taken into custody to a situation where there's at most going to be temporary detention and the issuance of a citation.
No. Well, Your Honor, your comment includes several incorrect assumptions. The officer would not have to take the person in custody and, in fact, would not even have to issue a citation.
No, I understand that, but that's the standard that you're asking us to apply to this situation.
Yes.
You're asking us to apply a probable cause to arrest standard when the reason for the suspicion is a traffic violation, a civil forfeiture.
Yes, because of the unreasonableness of allowing an investigative detention for these kinds of offenses.
Counsel,
where, for example,
you're saying that this is a seizure.
It is a seizure, no question about it.
And who's being seized?
The motorist.
And the car.
Obviously, yes.
So what's the difference between a seizure and arrest? And I never understood what's the difference between a stop and an arrest. If I say to the officer, hey, I pulled over, but I'm not standing around here because I'm in a hurry. You got my license number. You can send me a citation in the mail. I'm not going to be able to do that. That guy's got me, whether he says it or not, I am subject to his total control, and I'm, for all intents and purposes, arrested, but for a short time, even if he doesn't say you're arrested. I mean, maybe Terry, the U.S. Supreme Court can call that a stop and say it's not an arrest, but if you keep you any length of time, it is. And it's usually 10, 15 minutes by the time they finish with you. Not that I know from personal experience.
Which is why I call it an arrest.
Roughly.
Was there a question there, Your Honor?
Yeah, my question is, you are in effect saying, counsel, that this is an arrest.
It is an arrest.
And therefore, it's not unreasonable. I shouldn't use the word unreasonable. Therefore, because it is an arrest, you use the word seizure. Because it is a seizure, you should apply the same rules you apply to a seizure, which is probable cause. And I think that is the effect of Justice Sykes' questions to you in saying, and your response is it really is a seizure. She would say, and Terry would say, no, it's not. It may just be quibbling over words, but it's a stop. And once you say the magic word stop, then you get to the lower reasonable suspicion. Once you say the magic word arrest, get to probable cause.
I think it must be considered an arrest, and that's what the legislature calls it in section 345.22. Authority to arrest without a warrant.
Don't you have another potential grounding in the rule? I mean, because I agree with the chief, you know, I've never really quite understood the difference between a stop and an arrest, and I'm not sure that the Fourth Amendment requires an arrest, but that's a different, whole different chapter, because the Fourth Amendment talks about seizures. But that, isn't there another principle that you might be and I'm trying to simply understand those as you said, that given the minor, when you balance the minor value to society for a minor non-traffic offense against the freedom of the individual, because a stop necessarily involves some infringement of freedom, that there is so little gained on one side and an insufficient intrusion on the other, that you should require a higher standard to make that intrusion.
Yes, certainly. I've been trying to say that this afternoon.
May I ask? You're the officer on the scene that early morning. What should you have done?
I think I agree with the circuit judge that merely coming out from where some businesses are closed at 2 a.m. is not in and of itself reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. So that wouldn't justify a stop. And I think having plastic in your window absolutely definitely does not justify even an investigative stop, because it's an unreasonable interpretation of the statute. Therefore, the only thing that the officer could lawfully do is to follow or go about his patrol.
Well, he could also call in a license plate number and see if there's any stolen car.
Certainly. Anything that he could do without performing a seizure would be appropriate.
What's the section number, which I've now forgotten, on the Terry stop? We've got a statute.
Yes, we do.
We've got a Terry stop statute for crimes that are not on traffic.
Okay.
968.24.
Okay, that's what I was looking for.
Comparing that with 345.22, which authorizes arrests for traffic regulations. My time has run out, but there are really a few more things I'd like to say.
Well, first we're going to have just Bradley ask you a question, then we'll give you a few more moments since we gave Ms. Nashel some more time. But there's a limit.
Beyond which we will not go.
It's
unclear to me from a summary review of the record exactly why we are dealing with exclusively with 347.43. As I read the record on page 6, and the chief read this also, with regard to the plastic, the statement of the officer is, I did observe that it would offend the driver's rear window, passenger side, or passenger's rear window to be broken out with plastering, covering it, taped. That's page 6 of the transcript. Page 11 of the transcript says, and when you started the first question, and when you started the first time, you observed that the window had plastic covering it, was right before you stopped my client. Answer, approximately, etc. Affirming that, in essence. We're faced with a situation where I have no citation for any violation that was issued with regard to plastic in a window of a vehicle. So it isn't clear to me why we are discussing 347.43 as opposed to 346.88, which deals with nothing that you can only have transparent material, or the 305 regulations of the Department of Transportation that were referred to by Justice Prosser. I don't find anything in the record other than what I've read that deals with some kind of plastic on a window. So why are we focusing on 347.43 rather than the Department of Transportation regulations or 346.88?
Because that was the rationale that the officer offered, and it was the state's burden in trying to justify a warrantless seizure.
That's what I need. I read to you the only two things that I found in the record in a real summary review dealing with plastic on windows and the officer's testimony. Is there anywhere in the record that the officer testifies further with regard to that issue?
No, I don't believe the officer did testify further, and that's why, if you want to bring up the obstructing driver's view or something like that, the state simply hasn't proved that sort of an exception.
I mean, didn't the trial court ask for briefs, and then people started briefing things and giving law?
Yes, they tried to brief what the meaning of the safety glass law was. But the safety glass law was the rationale that the officer made.
But what I read to you was the exclusive record, as you understand it, with regard to the officer's testimony on plastic and glass and rationale relating to that.
I'm having difficulty following your question,
okay.
But that's all the officer testified to, is he saw a sheet of plastic taped in the rear passenger window.
Subsequent to his testimony, there was an oral argument by the attorneys, and Mr. Hitt, I think it is, the district attorney, and it is he who offers 347.43, but the officer didn't know.
If I may be allowed to keep
I have,
on.
I have just one question. Taped in the rear passenger window, I'm conceptualizing the vehicle. You have a driver and you have a passenger. Is this the whole window is out? No one knows. Okay.
He says okay. Passenger, then he says driver, and then...
My understanding, it was on the driver's side of the rear seat. It was a four-door vehicle. I'm going to be very quick now. I want to come back, though. If this court says that we can make traffic stops based upon, for civil offenses, based upon reasonable suspicion, the following things flow from that. An officer could, whether he chooses to or not, he could make a stop on suspicion of a defective muffler or a defective taillight, and he could keep you there up to 20 or 30 minutes while he investigates that. He could make the driver and the passengers get out of the car, and if he sees a screwdriver or something on the seat, he could search the inside of the car, all pursuant to this. And most significantly of all, you would have to answer his questions. Because this court held in State versus Goble that if an officer is allowed to make an investigative detention, part of that is asking questions for his investigation, and you have to answer them.
That happens every day in the city of Milwaukee, many times.
Okay, fine. But are we going to say that now it's legal for them to do it on all those occasions?
Well, that's what the law is now. You're asking us to change it.
I disagree with you there.
Rationale in the cases that you cited, Wren and Welsh and Hensley.
I don't believe there's any case that, as a matter of deliberately considered and carefully pronounced rule of law in Wisconsin, holds.
But you would agree that the standard that's being applied in courts across this state right now on just these sorts of stops is reasonable suspicion.
And is wrong
that's
to the extent that occurs. Yes, and is wrong.
And
what wrong under what? What is it wrong under?
Because the public interest in enforcing civil offenses is low compared with criminal offenses and border violations. So the ordinary Terry analysis does not apply. In addition, the typical fact situation involving an observed traffic violation does not justify further investigation, which is the second predicate of the Terry analysis. But as Justice Babbage pointed out, what I'm really saying is the reason why this is inappropriate is because the balance between liberty going around and about the streets and public highways in our cars would be vastly tilted against citizens for minor offenses if we allow reasonable suspicion stops.
Including drunken driving.
No, drunk driving I've tried to distinguish by saying that could sometimes be criminal.
Sometimes.
Yes. Can I have two more minutes, please?
Yes, you may, but really two.
Thank you. Can a mistake of law somehow justify, or not using the exclusionary rule in this kind of a case? There are four different reasons I have why not. First of all, if there isn't an offense in law because of the mistake, if the facts couldn't possibly be an offense, then how can we say that there is probable cause that an offense occurred? Second, the standard of probable cause is the same under the law for warrantless arrests as it is for arrests with a warrant. And the reason for that is to give officers an incentive to follow the warrant process and not to avoid it. If we allow officers to take mistakes of law and act on their own, it would give them a disincentive to go to the judge. Third, in this case, the officer is not relying upon any extrinsic apparent legal authority for his interpretation of the statute. Unlike Ward, this court's recent decision involving the knock and announce rule, that was clear legal authority officers could rely on. Other cases, DeFilippo, Krall, Peltier, which I've cited in my letter to the court, all involved laws that were later held unconstitutional, but at the time they were in effect, officers could clearly rely on them.
What I hear you say, counsel, just to interrupt you, but what I hear you say is that if the officer is insured, he shouldn't do anything.
That's right. at least for a civil.
I mean, isn't that a huge burden? I mean, we've got had judges now. How many more judges look at this case, and people still don't know what the law is? I still don't know until I think it through what that law says. And yet you're saying that the cop has to be completely sure before he can act?
I'm saying that where the offense is lying.
You have to stand in front of the microphone so I can get you.
And it isn't clear whether the officer is justified in believing there's a violation or not. Where the offense is minor, then the public interest militates against taking action and effecting a warrantless seizure.
The world doesn't come to an end because you don't stop him for the muscle.
Correct.
Okay, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and Ms. Nashholt.
Thank you. I must say that I'm a little caught off guard because of this new theory, so I'm going to be talking very quickly to try to get through all the points that were raised during the defense attorney's presentation today. From what I can tell, what the defendant is asking you to do in this case is to obliterate Terry. Just because someone stops someone and can ask them questions and have answers given back, and just because this detention can last for 20 to 30 minutes, it doesn't make it an arrest. What is important is the level of intrusion into the restrained person's liberty. And clearly, we have situations under the law that fall short of an arrest scenario, and that's what the court is addressing in this case, the stop of the defendant's vehicle. It's not an arrest, nor is giving a citation an arrest. That is made clear in Knowles that giving a citation is not an arrest. And defense counsel cites 345.22, which allows an officer to arrest for a non-criminal or for a traffic offense. That doesn't mean that automatically a citation is an arrest. That just does not support his position.
Counsel, if I could just interrupt again, maybe in the interest of fairness, or I don't understand, but you said this is a whole new position. Get on page 15 of the defendant's brief, he says, taken together, the Supreme Court's decision in Welsh, Terry, and Bernoulli, Fons, and then he also cites Wren, who violated a seizure for a completed or ongoing line of non-criminal offense, can't be validly founded upon a mere reasonable suspicion that this was a subjective fact, not justified for the investigation. This is the defendant's fundamental position in this case.
He says that, he concedes on page 13 of his brief that basically, the standard is usually, even for non-criminal traffic offenses, reasonable suspicion. But then he goes on to say, but not where no further investigation is needed.
Well, it's that brief. I mean, you're standing up here telling us that he's taking suddenly a whole new position.
Well, his position in the Court of Appeals and into this court was basically conceding that reasonable suspicion is the standard for non-criminal traffic offenses unless further investigation is needed. So, in other words, adopting some part of the Court of Appeals rationale, this idea of investigation. And now it's simply that whenever it's a non-criminal offense, regardless, and he's dropped the whole investigation idea, it's always probable cause. And there's basically no authority for this. I find his theories advanced today very interesting. However, I find this court's recent precedent much more compelling, and that precedent is Wren's. The court clearly stated in analyzing Fourth Amendment jurisprudence that the standard is reasonable suspicion. The Court of Appeals did so in Griffin, and there's an abundance of authority from other jurisdictions and from the U.S. Supreme Court in Prowse to indicate that the standard, even for a non-criminal traffic offense, is in fact reasonable suspicion. It's not an arrest. The defendant cites Wren, and Justice Babbage said that was cited in the brief, and that's correct. But Wren is inapplicable here. What that case dealt with was a pretextual stop, and in that case, the defendant was specifically arguing, you need more than probable cause. In other words, the officer had probable cause. So it wasn't a question of, well, what's the floor for what an officer needs? And so in that case, the court said, no, probable cause is enough. You don't need more, because what the defendant was arguing is that, well, there's so many traffic violations and people are going to be stopped all the time if the standard is only probable cause. And the court said, no, probable cause is enough. But Prowse addressed more what do you need? And in that case, I think it's pretty clear, especially from all of the cases that have interpreted Prowse, for this proposition that you only need reasonable suspicion. Furthermore, if this court, for whatever reason, buys the defendant's argument that the standard should be probable cause for all non-criminal offenses, probable cause, the state submits, was met here. Also,
wouldn't this new rule, or this rule, if we were to adopt it, just really gut community policing?
Absolutely, it would. There are numerous situations where an officer will have reasonable suspicion, but a court may find that probable cause was not met. Now, Justice Babich talked about, well, aren't you saying that this is just a minor intrusion? But we don't know what's going to happen after that. This will apply if there's a mangled body in the car, and then that would be suppressed. We don't know what's going to happen afterwards. And it is... I'm sorry, Justice Babich was talking about, well, this is a minor offense, but it's also a minor intrusion. And this...
Have you ever been stopped?
Have I been stopped? Do I have to answer that? I take offense on that.
When I see that red light go on behind me, which has...
Well, that was the basis...
It was the other car
that was stopped. That was the basis for Terry, though, that basically this is less intrusive than an arrest, that it's not an
Terry
arrest.
Terry was a crime, though.
I'm sorry?
Terry involved.
Terry was a crime, but that's not how the courts have read that analysis, that it doesn't just apply to crimes.
And what's your authority on that?
Renz?
Well, Renz, that was dicta, too.
Well, if it's dicta, Your Honor, it's been dicta in approximately a bazillion cases, because
okay, but
we have set...
You don't have a case precisely on point that says... For non-criminal.
I think that Prowse can be understood to say that. If you look at the language in Prowse.
That was not civil either, Prowse.
Well, they said that you either have to have probable cause or reasonable suspicion in Prowse. But
crime?
Yes, I believe that did involve investigation of a crime.
Have you followed a case that involved an arrest or a stop? For a minor civil offense that presents this direct issue, whether or not reasonable suspicion is the standard or probable cause.
I have not, but I think that it's so well established that courts...
So there's no law either way.
I think there is. If you look at the cases that I cite, pages 11 to 15 of my brief, then yes, that is the standard, and it's been the standard for a long time.
See, you might be right, but I just find it really interesting because in 17 years on the court, I've never had to confront it.
Well, we don't have a lot of suppression motions in
traffic
violation citations.
That's correct. That's an excellent point. We don't get to this level usually for most of these cases, but you take a room full of circuit court judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, and you ask them what the standard is for stopping a vehicle, I would be willing to bet money that they would say reasonable suspicion. And even the defendant in his own brief, as I stated earlier, just gave that standard because it's that well established. And just because there hasn't been an opinion directly addressing that, it doesn't mean that it's not well established. It's just such a given. It's like saying, you know, you need probable cause to arrest. The defendant got it right the first time when he said the standard is reasonable suspicion, and ever since when he's veered from that position, he hasn't presented this court with authority for that position. There's no reason to distinguish a jaywalking case from some misdemeanors. You know, that there's no reason to assume that just because it's a non-criminal offense that it's so easy to dispense with, that it's just so clear-cut. Also, just briefly, one of the reasons for, as defense counsel stated, one of the reasons for allowing Terry stops is that there's a need for prompt police action. And this is clearly that type of case. When you're talking about automobile stops, you're talking about a situation where there's ready mobility, where the officer has to make a split-second decision on whether to stop someone. And there's also a reduced privacy interest in the car. If there are no further questions, the state would simply ask that this court find that the stop was reasonable in this case and reverse the Court of Appeals decision.
Thank you. That ends our hearing on 98-2792 CR, and we are in recess until February